Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer. Our Father, we thank you this morning that we come to Thee not as servants or as slaves. Yes, we come to Thee that way, but we thank you that you treat us when we come with that attitude as sons, part of your family. Oh, Father, we're so thankful for that. And yes, there will be discipline, but it will be loving discipline. And there will be rebuke, but it will be constructive rebuke. And Lord, as we go through this day, we pray just deal with us as creatures of dust who desperately want to be all that you intended for us to be. And Lord, I pray for every home represented here. I pray that you would build a mountain around each home, a wall of protection, and that within that wall of protection, every child might realize your purpose for his creation. Bless us as we think together about how we should think as teachers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I'm very happy to be here today. And I think that the subject that we're going to be talking about is very much in order. Yesterday I worked in a home. It was not really a home, it was an empty house, but there were some people there. And one person came in with school-aged children, and I thought, well, this is rather unusual that a mother is here working on this house and they're school-aged children. And it wasn't long till I heard her say, so-and-so, you go out and bring in your books. And then I said, oh, you're having home school. And yes, she's having home school. But I observed through the day that it was not a very organized, not a very orderly home school. Now, if that had been an exceptional day where she had to do something and took the children along, I would have felt differently about it. But I got the impression that these children sort of got dragged from one job to another and sort of had their school whenever and however. And that capitalizes sort of a concern that I have for the homeschool movement. I think we all have that concern. I don't think I'm saying anything that you're not concerned about. I think you're all responsible people. But I remember when we brought the children out of public schools to have Christian schools, one of the things that happened was many people who were involved in that were not very responsible, and there was a bad testimony left on the matter of Christian education. And with the homeschool, there's even more possibility for irresponsibility. And so I think we owe it to our calling and to God to make the homeschool a real school. And so I think it's very appropriate that we learn to think like a teacher. A week ago, we had a teacher's institute in our community for conventional schools. And there was a germ of thought placed there years ago in my mind about a certain teacher in a teacher's college. A friend of mine said he had her as a teacher. And I said, well, what kind of teacher was she? Because I know that her name is very prominent. And if I said her name, some of you would recognize who I was talking about. I said, how was she as a teacher? Oh, he said, she finished her teacher education and went into a one-room elementary school to teach and taught there about a year. And she said, well, if these children can't appreciate my great understanding and what I have to contribute, well, I'll just not teach elementary school. I'll go and teach teachers. And so it always was in the back of my mind, well, how did she make out teaching teachers if that's how it went in her elementary school? So I asked a boy who was there last weekend, how does this teacher get along? You know, I know her name is a big name in the education department of the school where you went. Is she a good teacher? And he looked at me and he said, well, her only problem is she can't teach. Well, that's a pretty serious problem. He said she has the material. She has it organized. He said she's one of the most organized professors that he had. But she could not get the information across. And how sad. Because if you're a teacher and cannot teach, that's, I guess, a pretty serious flaw. All right, the word teach itself means to show how to do. Literally what it means. It means to take another person and show that person how to do something. And I like the emphasis on that definition, to show how to do. Teaching is intensely practical. It was a characteristic of the Greek to be intellectual. The Greeks seek after wisdom. They were constantly spinning philosophies, many of them very unrealistic. Did you ever hear the Greek philosophy about how the world came into existence? You go home and look it up. And many other philosophies of life they had often were not very realistic, or not, I shouldn't say they weren't very realistic, some of them were pretty realistic, but they weren't very practical. They didn't get down to where people live. A characteristic of Hebrew education, or thinking, or philosophy, was that it was intensely practical. And for that reason, if we really want to learn how to teach or to show how to do, one of the best places we can go is to the Word of God. And I'd like to recommend for you, if you have not read it, a book that has been around for a long time. It's under two different titles. The title it now comes under is Teaching Techniques of Jesus by Herman Harrell Horn. How many have ever read the book? Well, sell your shirt and buy one if you need to. It is really a good book. It was first published in 1920 under the title Jesus the Master Teacher. How many of you have read that one? I mean, it's the same book under different titles. Alright, it is a tremendously practical book on what is involved in teaching. It does the best job of analyzing Jesus as a teacher of any book I've ever seen. I will be quoting some from the book as we go along this morning. Jesus had the most difficult teaching assignment that anybody was ever given. He was sent to convince people that he was the Son of God, when to do that directly would have turned people off and would have defeated the whole program. Now, if you think you're ever faced with a situation where you cannot speak directly to the child because he wouldn't understand, his vocabulary is too limited or his concepts aren't developed sufficiently, and you have to explain a very hard concept, and you just can't do it directly, well, Jesus did that all the time. Jesus spent most of his life teaching indirectly. And for that reason, he provides a tremendous model for the teaching of children, because we do that much of the time. I want you to turn to Proverbs 25:2. Proverbs 25:2. Here is a basic principle that Jesus used over and over again, and we want to use it as the basis of our first point this morning. Proverbs 25:2. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. I'll read that again. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing. That is to say, that God delights in making truth not immediately obvious. Now, why does he do that? Well, he does it out of respect to a very definite characteristic that he gave to you and me, and that is the delight that we have in thinking that we have discovered the truth for ourselves. All right. So God has concealed in this universe, in this world, in the human body, from the microcosm to the macrocosm, truth abounding, but it has to be searched out. And in the search, we all give satisfaction, or derive satisfaction, for a basic characteristic of man, which is to search and to feel that we have discovered something. And Jesus used that to its maximum potential. And we'll try to see this morning how he did it. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. All right, so that's a basic principle that will run through much of our discussion this morning. So that is why the truth is not immediately obvious. That's why it has to be searched for. Because God knew that it would do something to our development and to our sense of well-being and sense of self-worth to have that princely quality challenged constantly. All right, so the first thing that a teacher is thinking constantly is, how can I stimulate inquiry? How can I stimulate inquiry? We don't live in this world very long, so we take everything for granted. The sun comes up in the morning, goes down in the evening. There have been many people that have never given that any serious consideration. And all of life sort of falls into its routine, and if we're not careful, we fall asleep. And we walk through life, and most of the things that happen that could be extremely instructive about life itself, we miss. So, the teacher is always thinking, how can I get these people to ask valid questions? How can I get them to think in an inquiring way? All learning begins here. If we do not stimulate within the child a sense of inquiry, he really will not learn what we're trying to teach him. One of the most effective examples of this was a meeting I wish I had attended, but I didn't know it was happening until it was afterwards. So afterward. How many of you were Dale Heisey's children's meeting that caused quite a sensation here a number of years ago, where he actually brought in a lamb? How many were at that children's meeting? How many heard about it? I thought maybe more of you would have. And I'm not sure exactly how he proceeded, but he explained about this lamb. It was a pet, I think, of the family, wasn't it? I'm not sure. Maybe it wasn't. But he tried to really win the sympathies of the children for this lamb. And then he had Aaron Shank. Interestingly enough, his name was Aaron. That's the high priest in the Old Testament. Got out this night. And they were going to proceed to kill this lamb and offer it as a sacrifice. And of course, these children by that time were so involved that, you know, they were all keyed up to what was going to happen next. And there was a sense of inquiry there. Now, what is going to happen? What is he going to do? What does this mean? And then in the middle of all of that, he said, well, now wait a minute, Aaron. We don't have to do this anymore. And the lamb was spared. Well, needless to say, whatever he said in the next 5 minutes, he said to a group of people who were very interested in what was being said. Sorry, the Gospels, which are the record of Jesus' life on earth, give at least 100 different questions that Jesus asked. He was always asking questions. What think you? Who does this belong to? And so on and so forth. The baptism of John, from whence was it? And we probably list a lot of them here. How is it that you sought me? What seek ye? Why reason ye in your heart? How can ye believe who receive glory one of another? What reward have ye? Is not life more than food? So, the lesson begins by attention, and we are constantly trying to stimulate inquiry through questions. And, of course, to ask good questions, you have to be a shrewd observer of life. Jesus obviously was observing what was going on around him. He was obviously observing the things that people were interested in, things they were thinking about, the things that were uppermost in their daily activities. All right, so we'll leave that one. But the teacher is always asking questions. Now, the second thing to stimulate inquiry is the one I will spend a little more time on, through stories. There is nothing that will stimulate inquiry and hold attention any better than a story. I just told that one about Dale Heisey, and I think I had your attention a little bit better than I have it right at the moment. All right. Stories always stimulate attention and stimulate inquiry. And the reason why a story is such a tremendous vehicle of teaching is that it indirectly challenges our stubborn prejudices. I'll never forget a number of years ago when I read a short story, which I included in the literature book which we published, called The Frill. How many have read the story? Just a couple of them. Carl Buck wrote that story at a time when American people were very prejudiced against the Chinese. And she was a missionary's daughter in China, and she saw the official American representatives there and how they were relating to the Chinese people. Now, she could have come back to this country and could have said, look, it's not the Chinese that are so stupid. It's the Americans who are so unjust. But she didn't do that. She told that in the form of a story. And she'd have gotten no audience, by the way, if she'd have done it that way. She told this story of this woman who was the wife of the postmaster in the village where she lived, the American postmaster who had quite a bit of influence, authority, money, and so on. And this woman was huge. She was overfed, and a lot of other things too, overbearing, and a number of other things you can list. And she was talking to another overfed friend of hers about the fact that she needed a dress. And she was complaining about how the Chinese tailors, they aren't responsible and they charge too much money, and on and on and on and on. I don't know. I'm not sure she said they charge too much money, but she was complaining about them. They were so irresponsible, and you've just got to learn how to manage these people. And so the Chinese tailor arrives in the middle of this conversation, and he is pictured very poor but very neat, clean and neat to the teeth, and extremely respectful. Just a total contrast to this, pardon the expression, slob of a woman. And he comes in and very respectfully asks her what she wants, and she very disrespectfully tells him what she wants. And you can tell he's scared to death of this woman. And he hangs on every word, trying to get it all exactly right, and then he goes home. And then you find out that he had never had any children, but he had a nephew that had children whom he loved. The nephew had had a bad accident on the job and was dying. He spent most of the day comforting the man while he was dying. And finally he died. of a burn. His leg was swelled, you know, and the wife had these three children, and she was distraught. And the tailor, this man was a tailor, did not know what to do because he had to buy a coffin for this man, but he had no money. Well, he thinks, well, if he hurries and gets this dress done, maybe he can get the money to buy this coffin. If he doesn't get the money to buy the coffin, he'll have to borrow the money, and interest was extremely exorbitant at that time, and if anybody borrowed money in China, they were as good as done financially. So he cannot borrow the money. This man, here he is. He's to be buried. He's already dead. And so he goes home. Now, after all day trying to comfort this nephew of his, he goes home. And he goes to his sewing machine, and he works most of the night, but he's too tired to put the frill on, which she said she wanted on this dress, around the neck. So he goes, gets a little bit of sleep, gets awake, works on this frill, irons it, hopes that it doesn't smell too badly like the cottage where he had been, where this man was dying, and takes it to this woman. And she right away flies up into a temper that she didn't want the frill. She told him the day before that she did. And he was hoping that he could pacify her so he could ask her for a little money in advance on another dress, and that would give him just enough to buy the coffin. And of course, the whole story ends with her very rudely throwing him out of the house and him going home and redoing the dress to suit her. I'm sorry, it didn't have the frill on originally, and then she decided she wanted it on. Anyway, he finally gets the whole thing settled, and she pays him, tells him his price is too high, and after he leaves the house, brags to the other woman how cheaply she got the dress done, how promptly she made him bring it, and how she handled the whole situation. And when you're finished reading that story, you are just full of indignation against American people in China. And you're just full of sympathy for the plight that these poor people were under and the simple, honest, straightforward way in which they tried to live and were constantly misunderstood and mistreated. That's what a story can do. It can take, you could, a person who was reading that story with prejudice in his mind against the Chinese would take that story, and there's almost no way they could read that story and come out with the same feeling as they had when they began. You could never do that with any kind of direct statement. That's an indirect challenge to prejudice. And teaching through stories is good that way, even with children. If you say, you shouldn't lie, well, you get further that way with children than you will with adults. But even with children, you'll get a whole lot further in telling stories. Like, on the way to town the other evening, Ann said to me, Daddy, tell me stories. Well, I don't know how you are, but my mind runs 100 miles an hour and I can't seem to think of it. And I finally landed on the boy who called Woof, Woof. Well, she's been telling that story ever since. You know, and of course, I always remind her of the moral. So she doesn't forget it. All right. Stories. Another thing that stories do is stories stir emotions. Direct statements, yes, stir emotions too, but they're usually negative. You see, in that story about the Chinese tailor, you not only get the truth, but you also get with that truth the kind of feelings that should go along with that kind of truth. And stories can do that, where direct statements do not. The beautiful thing about a story is it unites the world of ideals with the world in which we live. We see in those stories the ideals that we're all striving after. And the story becomes a parable, an earthly parable of heaven. In fact, I doubt if there's anything in this whole world that God has not intended, both in the world of nature and the world of human relations, that God has not intended to be a basic illustration of truth. I really doubt that. Somebody has said Jesus knew three books. The Old Testament, the book of nature, and the book of life. And out of those three books, he did all of his teaching. All right. How did Jesus do on the matter of stories? Well, in the New Testament, there are 28 comparisons or parables. There are 25 different stories. And they range. There's a tremendous range. I just wanted to read the range that they cover. They cover everything from things to plants to animals to people. We have the salt of the earth. These are some things. The light of the world. The city set on a hill. The light on a candlestick. Things that defile. The eye is the light of the body. New cloth sewn in an old garment. New wine in old bottles. A house divided against itself. Two houses built on a rock. The four soils. The dragnet. The hid treasure. The pearl of great price. The great supper. Plants. The fig tree. Both the budding fig tree and the barren fig tree, the seed growing in the ground, the mustard seed, the tares and the wheat, the leaven, animals, the carcass and the eagle, children's meat and dogs, the lost sheep, the sheep and the goats, and the human beings. It's interesting to me that 34 out of these 61 stories had to do with people rather than things. I thought that was interesting. The woman seeking the lost coin, servants given the talent, servants given pounds, unprofitable servants, children in the marketplace, the son asking for a fish or an egg, the disciple and his Lord, blind leaders, the two masters, the scribe instructed in the kingdom, the 10 virgins, and of course, the stories go on to 25 different stories in the New Testament. And interestingly enough, when God decided to give us his word, how did he give it? I've never actually estimated that. Every time I give a talk like this, I determine I'm going to go home and calculate it. I've never done it, but I'm going to assume that about 3/4 of the book is in story form. Now, God could have said, without faith, it is impossible to please me. And he could have said, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That's good truth, both of those statements. But somehow, that doesn't communicate quite like those disciples out there in that boat. And the storm comes up, and the Bible says the boat was full of water. What would you have done? Well, I know what I would have done. And yet Jesus said they shouldn't have done it. And we see ourselves in that boat. And we see what faith is. Faith is when the boat is full of water and going down, you still trust God and obey him. That's what faith is. And that's a much better statement. I shouldn't say it's a better statement, but it's a much more moving statement of what faith is than any abstract statement is made about faith anywhere in the Bible. And so God knew that we would need lots of stories. We'd need lots of just plain down to earth human illustrations before we would understand the profound truths he wanted to teach us. And if that's true of sophisticated adults, how much more true is it of children? And so if you're going to learn to be a teacher, and you're going to think like a teacher, you're going to think in terms of stories, stories, stories. D.L. Moody, one of the most effective communicators probably of the end of the last century, was known for his many, many stories. D.L. Moody had 12 Bibles. They were the kind of Bibles that were printed with the text on one side and the other page was blank. It was only printed on one side of the page. And he did like William McGrath. You ever see William McGrath's Bible? He has one like that. It's about twice as thick as it was originally. It's full of clippings and things pasted in and outlines written in, and it's just full of. D.L. Moody had 12 Bibles like that. And he had them just full of illustrations and outlines. And people who were going to give a children's meeting or a young people's meeting talk or something would go and beg him for one of his Bibles. And D.L. Moody had one stipulation. You may borrow my Bible with one stipulation. You add a story to it before you send it back. Now, if you're going to think like a teacher, you're going to think in terms of stories. Everywhere you can find them, you're going to collect them in your thinking. You're going to tell them to your children. And you're just going to be a walking storybook. Now, I want to say at the beginning, some people say, I do not have the quality of a teacher. I do not believe that because Jesus called every one of us to be a teacher when he said, go ye therefore and teach all nations. If you are not an effective teacher, the problem does not lie in anything that in you that is innately incompatible with teaching. The problem is you have not in some way dealt with something in your life that prohibits you from being a good teacher. I believe every person sitting here this morning has the capacity to be a good teacher. I believe every person sitting here this morning has the capacity to tell a good story. I really believe that. All right. So, we're going to stimulate inquiry through questions, through stories. Number three, through problems. Now, I don't know how it is with you, but when a problem presents itself to me, I always forget its tremendous potential. I shouldn't say I always do. Yesterday morning, we walked into a house and we brought 6-foot step ladders and 5-foot step ladders and we were going to paint. And there was a huge foyer right inside the door, about as high as the ceiling. And we looked at it and we said, well, we didn't bring the 8-foot step ladder. And we immediately fell into deep discouragement. I'm sorry, I can't give you a good solution to that problem because we had so much other work to do in that house. We just went ahead and did the other work, and today, I guess they brought the 8-foot stepladder along. They're going to paint it today. But, you know, those kinds of situations, what do you do as parents? Especially if one of the children loaded the truck. blame, criticism, pessimism, a bad mood. I'm saying that because it's the way I am. If you want to get a little more information on it, ask my wife. A teacher who is, and I'm not saying that'll never happen to us, but we need to recognize that we really lost the ball in the grass when that happened. Because every problem that God allows to come into your life was put there for the purpose of you inquiring and solving that problem in the presence of your children. I can't think of anything that I want any more for my children to learn than that thing. That problems were put there by a loving God to draw out of me all the best of my creativity and divine wisdom and you name it. And I want those children to see that the Christian is a person who has resources to meet all of life's problems. I don't know if I can inspire you with that. But I was really inspired by that as I was going through this talk. Why, Jesus not only solved all of the problems as they came to Him, but He made people aware of problems they didn't even know they had. He made abundant use of problems. He would tell a story and the disciples would throw up their hands and say, well, who then can be saved? And He would help people to see problems that were deeper than the problem they brought. Here came a man saying, Lord, my brother won't divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus helped him see, hey, you have a real problem. And it has nothing to do with the inheritance, or it has only little to do with the inheritance. All right, so, problems. Life is made of problems. A lot of those problems, you're not going to have to go looking for. They're going to come to you. In fact, almost all of the problems Jesus dealt with were problems that came to Him in the course of a day. And He stood there in the midst of all those with perfect poise and showed the disciples that there is an answer for all of life's problems in the abundant life which He came to provide. And I'm going to go home today. This talk did something for me. I'm going to go home today and I'm going to determine that by the grace of God, when problems come up, I'm going to take that attitude. And if you're going to be home teachers and you're going to show your children, you have the very best opportunity in the world. Now, a teacher in a classroom, and I taught there 14 years, has enough problems too. But many times they're artificial problems. But you have the opportunity, an unparalleled opportunity, to show children. We're gonna show how to do that teach. You have the opportunity to show them how you take a measuring stick and measure and improvise and work. If it's a physical problem, if it's a moral problem, you know how to, you have the resources for that. You're gonna show these children exactly how to take the resources you have and solve the problem. Here are some of the problems that Jesus faced. Sabbath observance. What are we going to do about Sabbath observance? The scribes say this. And you say this. Forgiveness of sin. Association with sinners. Fasting. Observance of tradition. The coming of Elijah. Who is the greatest? Divorce. Tribute. Who are we going to pay it to? The resurrection. The waste of the ointment. All right. So, Jesus faced all of man's moral and religious needs and inspired men to find the satisfaction of all their problems in the abundant life which He came to provide. So, you're going to go home today as a homeschool teacher and you're going to welcome problems. And I understand, by the way, we don't have a homeschool. Our oldest is 4 years old, so we'll see it in the future. But I understand from what I'm hearing from most homeschool teachers that the homeschool increases problems, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Scheduling, just plain down physical stamina, creativity. All right. You're going to welcome those. You're going to show children that under the intense pressure of having a homeschool, life can be happy, full, satisfying, and that all of your needs can be met. You're going to show them that. I once heard a tape by Tony Campala. How many have ever heard of Tony Campala? The Day the Dollar Died, you know, all of that. Somebody asked him one time why he took the direction he did with his life. His parents apparently were wealthy. Is that true? I think they were. They had been wealthy. And he said, well, he said, the thing that made the greatest impression on me was that there was never anybody that came to our door who was not welcome. He said, I many times saw my mother clean up the vomit or whatever from the bed of a drunk who had spent the night there. And she did it without a complaining spirit. She did it with a spirit of service. Now, our children, and hear me on this, we're so worried about their, you know, what's going to happen in light of what's going on in our world and associations with all that corruption and sin out there. You know, that was the most beautiful place on the whole earth. Whatever mom and dad believe must be something better than what anybody else believes. And this, as a teacher, as you think your way through your problems, you're going to show this. You're going to show it to your children. I'm not too long on abstracts this morning. I'm trying to stick to the practical. We're going to show it to our children by the grace of God. Our homes are little laboratories. We had a couple come into our home this summer who were trying to solve all kinds of problems, theoretically. And I said, look. And I said, I'm not going to dig too far to find out what's happened in the past or what happened in your other relationships. I said, you've come here to our home. And we're not going to live here very long until whatever problems you have are going to surface right here. We're not going to have to go talk to a lot of other people to find out. We're going to see it right here. If I tend to be irritable, you're going to see it in a day or two. If you tend to respond in a certain way, we're going to see it in a day or two. And then we're going to deal with the problems right here when they come up right here. And if we can't live right here, then we can't live anywhere. You follow me? All right. And that's how we're going to... That's going to be our mentality as a teacher. Our home is a little laboratory. It embodies all of the potential problems and situations that children are going to meet anywhere. And we're going to show the children how to get through all of those things. Well, I'm ready for my fourth point. Through conversation, we're going to stimulate inquiry. Through conversation. You know, ideas are oftener changed by familiar talk than by formal speeches. Most of Jesus' teaching was done as he walked by the wayside. See, that's the beauty of the home school. In the classroom, we try to do this, but more in the classroom than anything else, it's lecture. It's lecture. Formal lecture. Now, children, pull the blind down over there so that truck gets fast. No, preach, preach, preach. No. And I did 14 years of that, and I don't know if I'll go back to that or not. But your opportunity as a homeschool teacher are so much better. It's so much better. All right. But conversation is a fine art. I had a lady tell me not too long ago who was in our home a few times. She said this a year or so ago. She said, well, one of the things that attracts her to our homes is you people know how to converse. Now, this was new to me. Now, it's true, in our home we knew how to converse. But I wasn't aware in the home that I grew up in. In fact, at the dinner table, if anybody ever came to our place for lunch, and a few people did and said, shook their head in disbelief that anybody could understand what anybody was saying. I mean, we all talked at once. That was bad. I'm not recommending that. But she said, you know, you go out there and visit in many homes, most homes out there in the world, and she said, they don't know how to converse. Well, I said, well, what do you do when you go to visit? Well, she said, you go to visit, you turn on the TV program, and you all watch it together and sort of make comments in between, however. Well, I don't know if that's true or not. But it is true that conversation is a fine art. It is a fine art. It takes intelligence. Well, before I say that, how many of you have ever tried to talk to people where you had to provide all the stimulus to keep the conversation going? In fact, that's many people. That's most people. You're not going to get anywhere as a homeschooling parent if you don't work on that problem. Because you're going to stimulate inquiry by constantly talking, calling children's attention to things they have not seen and making comment about it and showing them that there's more there than meets the eye and just constantly talking about everything as you go down through life. That's going to be an important part of it. All right. Conversation is a fine art that requires intelligence. If you're going to be a good conversationist, you're going to read a lot. You're going to listen well to what other people are saying. You're going to observe. You're going to intelligently analyze. You have nothing to talk about.
It also takes discipline. I have found that to have good conversation, it takes effort on my part. I have to determine I'm going to converse with these people. How many of you have the tendency when you're in a group of people to just sort of fold your hands and make no effort and sort of stand off to the side and listen to what they are saying? How many have that tendency? Well, sure, we all do. So it's going to take discipline to be a good conversationalist. It's going to take good humor. A good conversationalist has good humor. You listen to a person who is well-liked as a conversationalist, known as a good conversationalist. They have wit. And their conversation is spiced with all kinds of subtle humorous comments. And they're not, you're not always holding your sides listening to them. There are some that you do, but they're witty. When I say that, I don't want you to get carried away and say, well, I'm not witty, so I can't be a conversationalist. But this person has learned to interject good humor all the way through the conversation to keep everybody's spirits on the positive side. Charitableness. This person is considerate of other people. There's the one I really have to work on. Those of you who know me know if I have something to say, I butt right smack in the middle of your conversation and say it. A good conversationalist does not do that. Candor. The good conversationalist is open. You get the feeling there's nothing in his life that he's trying to hide. He's not ashamed to tell you what's on his heart, or just to be plain down honest, even though it may not seem to be the best policy at the moment. There's candor there. You don't have the feeling that you're not really able to completely share in his life. There's sympathy there. I had an aunt who died with leukemia a number of years ago, Aunt Martha. She was not a Mennonite. She was a United Methodist. And those of you who know some of the things that have gone on in the United Methodist Church in recent years may say, well, that doesn't sound too good. And I don't know what all her beliefs were, but there was one thing about Aunt Martha that made us all miss her tremendously when she died. And she was a professing Christian, by the way, and had a glowing testimony. And I just thought about it the other day when I was working. I was trying to think, what was the characteristic of that woman that made her so outstanding? And here's what it was. She had the ability to make everybody, no matter how humble they may have been in their circumstances, feel like they were one of the best friends that she had. She had that ability. I had an old aunt who was bowed over with old age and who was not very well read or very well versed or very well traveled or anything else, and her ideas of life were extremely narrow. And I'd have thought a person with the cosmopolitan view of life that Aunt Martha had would not have had much time for Aunt Fanny. But there was one thing Aunt Fanny could do. She was a gardener par excellence. So Aunt Martha came to visit Aunt Fanny one day and said, I don't know how to garden. Would you teach me to garden? And for the next 3 or 4 years, Aunt Martha came regularly, and half of the garden was hers and half of the garden was Aunt Fanny's. And Aunt Fanny was unbelievably devoted to that woman. Because with all the superiority she had, she made Aunt Fanny feel like she had something she did not have. A good conversationalist does that. I'm weak in that too. People tell me that when I converse, I make people feel like I know it all. That's bad. That's very bad. Maybe the reason I make people feel that way is because I know I don't. You know, all right, well, whatever. All right? Sympathy. And apply this now to your children. You're going to have to relate in this way. Earnestness. What I have to say, I really believe is important. Sincerity. What I have to say, my whole life will support. And modesty. All right. Now, of course, to be a good conversationalist, you have seen in that list, means you're going to have to live well, because the Bible says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. So you're not only going to work on your oral skills, you're going to have to work on your total life to be a good conversationalist, because you're going to talk about the things that are nearest to your heart. In fact, that's what you're going to talk about to your children. And it is amazing to me, as I've watched over the years as a teacher in a Christian school, that after all I had said and after all I had done, most of the children that I taught basically came out approximately where their parents were. That was the disappointing part in some cases to me. Because there's where the conversation was day after day, if the parents were good conversationalists. And that's what the children basically identified with when it's all finished. And that's the way it should be. While that was said in some cases, that's as it should be. That's the way God designed it to be. So we need to be concerned about that, because that's the way it's going to be. Here's where my father shone. And, you know, not every member of our family has espoused everything that Daddy taught. But my father, and I've been in a lot of homes, and I've observed that the homes generally that succeed are really strong on this point. And my father was. A trip to town was just as informational as a trip to the museum with my father. If there was a turtle crawling along the side of the road, Daddy always had time to stop, pick up the turtle, tell all he knew about it, which wasn't very much sometimes, take it home, look it up in the encyclopedia, build a cage for it, learn how to feed it, you know, whatever. That was my father. You would be driving home from church, and in a Mennonite parking lot, at that time most people drove modest cars, but there was a bright red car. Well, that never escaped Daddy's notice. And the rest of the way home, you got a lecture on that subject. And here was Daddy's bad point. He talked about people. I knew all the sins of everybody in our whole community through the generation he lived through, plus the generation before. That was the bad point. But he said, I want to tell you something. That boy's father grew up with me. And I want to tell you some decisions he made down along the line and see where it ended up. There it is. Now, if you want your children to go that way, you just live the kind of life his father lived, and his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. Like I said, that got a little bit wrong, and that was my father's fault. But he had an irresistible urge to tell us all the things that he had learned as we went the other way. And that's what Jesus did. He taught as he journeyed. And that's what we're going to do. All right, I'll just quickly review those. We're going to stimulate inquiry through questions. We're going to learn to ask good questions. Through stories, we're going to gather up all the stories we can gather up, and you'll never have too many. Through problems, we're going to show our children how to solve problems. And through conversation, we're going to develop the fine art of conversation. Well, I could sit down right now. That's enough for us all to work on, I'm sure. The second major point, the first one was we're going to stimulate inquiry. The teacher thinks in terms of stimulating inquiry. All right, the second thing, a teacher thinks in terms of instilling the truth. Now he has the attention. Now he has the object lesson. Now he has the story. Now he has the problem. His next concern, now that he has the attention and the inquiry of the child, is how is he going to get this information to stick? Well, first of all is this. He's going to have a definite aim to instill truth. My father's dead, so I don't object to talking about him some. But you know, I got the impression, as I was growing up, that my father, and I'm sure if he were here in the audience, he would say this was not the right impression, but this impression I got anyway, that my father never once entertained the thought, seriously at least, that any of his children would go astray. And that always troubles me when I hear people talking about, well, can you be sure your children are going to turn out, or, you know, what about this, and what about Judas, and what about, hey. My father never talked about those things. I got the impression that my father had laid down a purpose before any of his children were born, and that is that by the grace of God, every one of them would learn to live the way he lived. Now, I'd sooner have that aim and fail than to come to the end and realize I hadn't even had that aim. And so the teacher, this is the mentality of the teacher. The mentality of the teacher is, the children or the students are going to learn the truths that I have learned in my experience. Whatever it takes, I'm not quite sure how we'll get it all taught, but we are going to teach it, and they're going to learn it. There'll be no chance involved. There will be a definite program. Now let me give you seven aims that I think that we should have. I'll try to give them slowly so you can copy them down. Seven aims that I would have laid out in my mind for my own life and for my children. Number one, at the top of the list, is to form good character. I don't care how poor, how unfortunate in life circumstances I happen to be. If my children can come through with good character, nothing else matters to me. That's all that matters. And that should be an aim. In all the stories that you tell, in all of the problems that you go through, this is going to be one of your aims. That by all means, we will not violate any basic principles of good character. The children will learn to be upright people of integrity. Number two, that's a moral. That's a moral aim. Number two, another aim of mine is to refine my children's feelings and increase their sensitivity to the world around them, especially the people in the world around them. So that they become sensitive to the impressions that are coming to them, especially the needs of people around them. To refine their feeling and increase their sensitivity. Yes, I want my children to know the difference between a beautiful picture and an ugly picture, and I want them to know why it's different. I want them to have a feel for that. I want them to have a feel for good music. I really will be very disappointed if the favorite music of my children is Bill Gaither's type of music. I really will be disappointed. I will be very happy if their taste for music is A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and the Hallelujah Chorus, and all of the other songs that represent the ideal and what is really beautiful and what is really right. Alright. To refine feeling. I guess in our society that's called taste, that's called sophistication. I don't know what it's called. That sounds carnal to me, but let's not let that carnal attitude scare us away from the fact that our children should embody, represent, and be sensitive to and promote all in life that is the most beautiful. Whether it is in manners at the table, whether it's in art, whether it's in music, whatever. Let's have the best that we can possibly have. Now, don't carry that to some carnal extreme. Every one of these, except maybe that first one, has its hazards. That's the aesthetic.
I'm just going to summarize these in one word.
All right, number three. My third goal for my children, for myself, these are all for me and my children, to inform and equip the intellect.
Well, that would sort of scare us away, man. And it only will tear us away if it's out of proportion to any of these others. All right?
I want my children to know all the information they can possibly learn. That's what I want. That doesn't presuppose they're going to college. It doesn't presuppose any of the things maybe that come to people's minds when that's discussed.
But however, whenever, and wherever, I want my children to learn all they can possibly learn about this large, full world that God has placed at our disposal. I want them to know that.
All right, number four. I want to make them a good church member. Now, let me explain. I'm not talking about a formal church member. I'm talking about a good church member where they understand what it means to be a functioning part of a body. And make their contribution. And take their responsibility. And to love and to serve their enemies in the church if that happens.
Alright.
In other words, that it can be said when they pass off the scene that a strong influence that helped to make this church what it has been through the years in all that was good and right about it, we have lost.
That's the first one. And I want to call your attention to the fact that we're going to find it, you know, the emphasis is in the church. It's in the church.
I'm really not interested in much social activity outside the context of the home and the church. All right, number five. To develop a sound body.
Yes, I make no bones of the fact that I believe in healthful eating and good habits of hygiene and exercise and all that goes under the name of natural or health living or whatever you want to call it.
And the fact that some people have been fanatical and unrealistic does not
minimize the fact that Christians of all people, when all the research is done and all the
truth about the subject is tabulated, that people say, well, there's a group of people that have been living that for years. That's the way they have lived. I think it's too bad when Rodale has to teach Christians how to eat nutritiously.
And when people from the world have to tell us that certain things are junk food, I think that's too bad. I think Christians should have been sensitive to that all through the years.
All right, so I want my children to develop a sound body.
There again, you run away with that out of proportion to the rest, and you're going to have a problem. But in its place, it's beautiful and it's right.
I think it's just a good testimony to the gospel of Jesus Christ for the people who represent it to be as healthy as God made it possible for them to be. All right, number six. I want to cultivate in my children productive skill. I'm up against a handicap right now. I stepped outside of the classroom, and unfortunately, I really don't have a marketable skill. I'm not a carpenter. I'm not an electrician. I'm a dairy farmer. I could dairy farm. But you can understand why I'm not planning at the moment to go into that.
After teaching in the Christian day school,
I wouldn't have the money to begin with. All right. That's unfortunate. Now, I'll tell you how it happened, and I'm not rebelling against that, because there really was no way for me to do anything differently from what I did. My father was sick, and it was only because he insisted that I go through high school that I did. Otherwise, it would have been very easy for him to use me at home from the time I could get out of school. But father said, you finish high school. I'm glad he did. And we sacrificed. I would miss 20, 30 days out of the school year to haul manure in the fall and plant corn in the spring, and the school officials sort of put up with this, and we worked through it, and I got through high school. But the minute I got out of high school, my father needed me desperately on the farm, when many of my friends went and worked as carpenters or cabinet makers or masons or whatever. So I never had that opportunity. And I was home a year, and I felt the Lord calling me to teach, so I went to college. Then I taught, then I wrote textbooks, and then I taught some more and farmed a little bit in between, and that's all I have ever done. Now, I want something a little better than that for my children. I really do. I want my children to learn whatever skills they can learn. I want them to learn. That's just good living. All right. I think we're running out of time. I must quit here. Number seven. And this one you maybe would have put first. I put it at the end sort of so it would, you know, everything would just sort of point in this direction. And that is to relate all of life to its source and its goal. I want them to see that there is nothing in life that does not, if you understand it properly, all go back to the source. Now, we can say that abstractly, but I want to show them that. I want them to see that and feel it and innately sense it. All right, so we instill the truth through definite aims, and I've given you a couple. Now I'm going to just quickly go through the rest, and I won't have time to be a good teacher. I won't have time to illustrate. The next point under instilling truth is through apperception. That is, teaching the new in terms of the old. Children are always trying to do this. Why, one child heard somebody praying in a prayer meeting that God would send more laborers into the foreign field. And she went home and asked her father why at this season of the year they need more laborers in the cornfield. I think it was in the winter. Or Teddy Roosevelt, who said he was afraid to go in the church building because he might be eaten up by the zeal of thine house. Apparently he thought the zeal was an animal of some sort. I thought, And I had an uncle with whom we called Shorty, and I never could figure out why we called him Shorty, because he was not short, but he was Shorty. And at communion, we always sang this song that ended by the first verse by saying, where is it here? Before thy throne, my Shorty stands. I could not understand that one. All right. So children often make the wrong connection, but a very important principle is to try to relate. Jesus did it all the time. He talked about soil. You know, they all knew what a farmer was and what kinds of soil there were and so on. And Jesus related the new to that. Interpreting the new in terms of the old. And I can talk more about it, but we'll just leave that. All right? The third point under instilling truth is through concrete example. There's no point talking about an animal if it's a bluebird. The minute you say bluebird, they see the thing. They see the color, they see the shape, its nasty disposition, and the whole thing. All right. So we try to be as specific and as concrete
Because one of the principles of learning is that we learn basically through the five senses. Now, there's a sense in which we learn intuitively through the spirit. I'm not neglecting that by making this comment. But much is learned by concrete experience. So we make our learning as concrete as possible, as little abstract as necessary until they get the principle. Then we can talk in terms of abstract. After a child knows what two really means, then you can show him that thing, which would never tell you what two is. All right? There's a whole list of these in here. It's very interesting, but I won't have time to read it. All right? The fourth one under instilling truth is through repetition. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to say the thing over and over and over again. You might do that, too. And by the way, teachers have learned what we call program repetition. You talk about it, and then in the same class period, you talk about it several times. And then the next day, you talk about it, maybe twice. And then the next day, two or three days later, it's reviewed again. A week later, it's reviewed again, and the period gets stretched out. But there must be programmed repetition. But the beautiful thing about Christ is he did what every person who's trying to apply this principle did. He seldom ever said the same thing exactly the same way. If you don't have repetition, they will never learn it. If you have perfect repetition, they will be bored. So a principle of all good teaching is repetition. And it's corollary. Don't ever have this, the one without the other. Variety. If you have variety without repetition, they won't learn anything. If you have repetition without variety, they'll learn very little. They'll be bored. You must have both. In fact, all good talk, all great music, all great anything in terms of communication obeys this principle. Joyful, joyful, we adore thee, which is a great hymn of the church. We could sing it together. Let's sing it. Joyful, joyful, we adore thee, God of glory, Lord of us. I come forward for thee, for thee. What's that? Hail thee as the Son of God. What's that? All right. Let me tell you what the verse is. Field and forest, vale and mountain, blossoming meadow, blossoming tree. What's that? Totally different from the other. Last line, standing bird and flowing fountain. What's that? All great pieces of music or art are built on that principle of repetition with variety. The problem, by the way, with the Gaither music is it has too much of this. It's out of proportion. All right, but if you're going to instill the truth, you must obey this principle. And you must obey this principle along with it. The third main point. We've stimulated inquiry, we've instilled the truth, and now we're going to provoke to action. There is no impression without expression. Jesus gave people things to do. Let me just read you a few of them. Come, follow, go, sell, preach, watch, pray, do likewise, watch, offer the gift, stretch forth thy hand, roll ye away the stone, come down. Go and tell, sin no more, feed my sheep, make disciples of all nations, bring the colt, pay the tax, show thyself to the priest, arise, take up thy bed, go ye, then give ye them to eat, work, compel them to come in, turn the other cheek, etc., etc., etc. Jesus was always getting his followers to do something, to respond. In an astral form of some astral form of expression. And my concluding comment of the morning is the teacher who thinks like a teacher, like Jesus, will value each child as an individual. The person who does not have a teacher's heart is teaching, I don't know what he's teaching, but he's trying to make everybody the same. And you as parents, you know, as I went through this, I was just so blessed how it is almost impossible to do any of these rites in the classroom. You have all the opportunity in the world to do these rites. Every one of you knows the individuality of your child better than anybody else.
And Proverbs 22:6 it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old enough to depart from it, I'm convinced more and more means that each of your children has a definite plan that God has for his life, and if you can but cooperate with that plan, that child will respond just as naturally as a tomato plant responds if you don't try to grow it like a pepper plant. I think the problem with many children, in fact, I think it could almost be said all children that have somehow missed their calling did so because somewhere along the line, somebody tried to make of them something God never intended for them to be. And they became frustrated, and they became bitter, and they reacted, and they had wrong thoughts about their parents, and they had wrong thoughts about God, and they had wrong thoughts about life, and they headed off on the road to destruction. Jesus valued each person as an individual. He did not say to all of the apostles, you're going to be a rock. He said that to Peter, because that was God's intention for Peter. And so I will conclude quickly with this comment. Our purpose is, as it says in Colossians 1:28, that we may present every man, every child, perfect in Christ.